The orders of the court are herein pronounced and are posted outside and in the clerk's office for your inspection. This morning we have three causes which will be submitted to the court by oral argument. In the order in which they will be presented, they are as follows. Gordon L. Rourke, Jr. v. Stallworth Oil and Gas, Incorporated, and others, from Parker County. William E. Twyman v. Sheila K. Twyman, from Travis County. Then Federal Land Bank Association of Tyler v. William C. Sloan and others, from St. Augustine County. In each of these causes, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present argument. The petitioner may reserve time for rebuttal by so advising the marshal in advance out of that 20 minutes. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each cause, but we will finish all of these arguments before we break for lunch. Counsel in the second and third causes are not required to remain in the courtroom while earlier matters are being presented, but please remain nearby so that we may proceed to your cause without delay. These arguments are being recorded by audio machine for the convenience of the court, and should you desire to listen to the tapes of the arguments, you may make application with our clerk. Justice Hightower will participate in these causes and is expected to arrive momentarily. Court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Rourke v. Stallworth Oil and Gas.
May it please the court, in order to properly consider this case, two elements must be kept in mind. First, it's a summary judgment case. And secondly, the trial court summary judgment could only be based upon the language found in the respondent's motion for summary judgment, found at page 91 of the transcript, which says, there is no genuine issue of material fact as to there having been no consideration given by plaintiff to defendants to support the 5-14-79 letter agreement. The issue can't be stated any better. Was there consideration given by the plaintiff, now the petitioner, to the respondents who were the defendants? In order to stand muster to justify the summary judgment, the respondent's motion and the evidence must clearly show want of consideration as a matter of law. That's the holding of this court in Swilly v. Hughes. Evidence favorable to the non-movement will be taken as true, and every reasonable inference must be indulged in favor of the non-movement, and any doubts resolved in his favor. This court's opinion in Wilcox v. St. Mary's University. And even more importantly, summary judgments must stand on their merits and cannot be granted on the failure of non-movement's proof if the movement has not conclusively established his affirmative defense. This court's opinion in City of Houston versus Clear Creek Basin Authority. The only possible basis for the summary judgment for want of consideration is to give unequivocal meaning to the respondent's deemed admissions. It must be said that they clearly established no consideration paid by the plaintiff to the defendant for the contract as a matter of law. Not only did the deemed admissions not address this issue, they are unclear and they're subject to interpretation. They never get to the question of whether or not consideration was paid by the plaintiff to the defendants for the letter agreement. Deemed admission number two reads as follows. Any and all consideration which Roark has received from Stallworth or Roark thinks he is entitled to receive from Stallworth under the May 14, 1979 agreement was and is gratuitous. Any reasonable mind would not interpret this statement to read Roark paid no consideration to Stallworth. It doesn't even smack of such interpretation. And since it must be interpreted in the light of every reasonable inference being indulged in favor of Roark and any doubts resolved in his favor, it must in no way be said to support the proposition that Roark paid no consideration to Stallworth. This has to be the basis for the summary judgment because of the motion.
The deemed admission negates consideration Roar proceed to install it, correct?
Whatever the deemed admission says, Your Honor, it says that any consideration Roark has received from Stallworth, it starts out saying that. The motion was granted on the basis that Roark paid no consideration to Stallworth, the exact reverse, if you will.
If it was gratuitous, that would negate the consideration
of
the contract.
I'd like to discuss that. If
well,
I may,
I'd invite you to do that.
The respondents argue that the letter agreement amounts to a gift because of this deemed admission, and relying upon language found in Healy versus Healy and other cases, they say that there was simply no consideration as a matter of law. We say that the Healy case involved corporate stock and not real estate, and that case does not hold that if a promise is gratuitous, there is no consideration as a matter of law. This is reading into that decision something that just simply isn't there. A careful reading of the cases cited by the respondents revealed that in cases involving conveyances of real estate or a contract to convey real estate, a mere recital of consideration is the antithesis of a gift. Kunkel versus Kunkel, which is cited in the Woodworth case cited by the respondents, clearly refutes respondents' argument. That case involved a claim that a deed reciting consideration in the form of notes which were forgiven was in reality a gift. The court pointed out that the descriptions of the note and the deed of trust were not mere recitals, but they were recitations that are contractual in nature, which absent circumstances of fraud, accident, or mutual mistake may not be impeached by parole testimony, so as to destroy the unambiguous terms of the note and deed. Consideration or want of consideration is attempting to be shown by the respondents in this case by parole evidence in the form of a deemed admission. We claim that that is not correct and it is not permitted. The letter agreement was a completed contract when it was executed. It is not subject to variance by parole, whether by deemed admission or otherwise. And it is not properly denied enforcement by the summary judgment of the trial court. Remember what the respondents are saying. There was no consideration as a matter of law. The court in Hilly cites Piva House versus Lubbock National Bank, in which a husband and wife attempted to partition community property, and the deed in question recited $10 and agreed division of the property as consideration. And recall, we have a recited consideration in this letter agreement now before the court. The Court of Civil Appeals held in that case, this instrument does not evidence a gift by the husband to the wife, since gift means a voluntary transfer of property by one party to another without any consideration. If there is consideration for the transfer, the rights of the parties to the transaction are contractual and determined by the law of contracts. And then when the parties in Piva House attempted to prove that the deal was a gift, the court said that oral testimony cannot be admitted to vary the terms of that written agreement. It's our argument simply that if this deemed admission by this court's decision, it says that terms of a written agreement may be varied by parole testimony, and there is no claim of any fraud, accident, or mistake, I think we have indeed espoused a dangerous precedent.
Counsel, you weren't entitled to introduce any evidence to contradict the deemed admission, were you?
No, sir.
And is it your understanding that consideration would have to flow not only from Stallworth to Roark, but from Roark to Stallworth?
Yes, sir.
That flow both ways, and the admission effectively negates consideration flowing from Stallworth to Roark because it says that that was gratuitous.
What?
Thus negating half of the flowing of consideration from Stallworth to Roark.
but the summary judgment was granted on the basis that no consideration flowed from Roark to Stallworth. In the face of recited consideration in the agreement and testimony in the deposition that it was paid. And you've got to twist this gratuitous language around to say that as a matter of law, there is no consideration, and we simply say that you've got to have admissible evidence of that in order to refute the plain, unambiguous terms of that written letter agreement. And the cases that counsel has cited just simply do not do that. They don't say that. I'm not sure that these deemed admissions, or the deemed admission, that, of course, number two is the one that's important, are not akin to those that were looked at by the Court of Civil Appeals at Waco in 1964 in White v. Watkins, wherein it was held that deemed admissions that call for conclusions, opinions, and statements of subjective intent should not be admitted deemed facts. We're dangerously close to that with this deemed admission in the language that it's in. There is no claim anywhere in here that there's fraud, accident, or mistake such that any parole testimony should be admissible to vary the terms of that written agreement. And unless you can jump through the hoop that's been created and say that this gratuitous language wipes out any claim that varies that written agreement, I can't see how it affects the enforcement of this letter agreement. We have never seen that. I think the court, trial court and the Court of Civil Appeals, or Court of Appeals, have both gotten off on that track and have erred in doing that. And we feel that the issue, the fact issue, is big. So, special Stallworth consideration is a fact issue that is disputed and should be tried by the trial court. And we respectfully request that this case be reversed and remanded.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court. Mr. Thomas Fox will present argument for respondent.
May it please the court. My name is Talmadge Boston. I represent the Stallworth defendants who are respondents in this action. Petitioner Roark has raised two issues which this court has said it wants to hear in granting application on point of errors numbers 2 and 3. The first one is whether Mr. Roark's summary judgment response in the case created material fact issues, and the second is whether Stallworth's motion for summary judgment was based on satisfactory summary judgment proof which established that the May 14, 1979 letter agreement lacked legally sufficient consideration. Now, in order to evaluate that first issue, which is that of the summary judgment response sufficiency, we must first evaluate the state of the summary judgment record and the summary judgment proof, understand what that proof was, and then decide whether that proof creates fact issues. Now, as of the time of the hearing on the motion for summary judgment proof, as Justice Corn has already pointed out, the summary judgment proof was made up entirely of the deemed admissions and the May 14, 1979 letter agreement. No evidence submitted by Roark in terms of the Stallworth deposition excerpts or the Roark affidavit could be considered, and it was error if it had been considered, in order to vary or contradict the deemed admission. So, and that is established by the cases cited in my brief. And the Court of Appeals in this case agreed, because you will notice in the Fort Worth Court of Appeals opinion, they make absolutely no reference to Roark's response in opposition to the motion for summary judgment. And that's because they knew it would be error to attempt to vary or contradict the deemed admissions. So given that the only summary judgment proof which was properly before the court for it to consider on whether or not this May 14, 1979 letter was supported by consideration, the evidence was the deemed admissions, which each of you has a copy of, and I've enlarged here, and I apologize if it's not as good quality as I had hoped, as well as the May 14, 1979 letter. The trial court and the Court of Appeals held that these deemed admissions and the letter collectively establish the following 3 points. The first is that the consideration which Mr. Roark delivered to Stallworth on May 14, 1979 was merely that of past performance. Specifically, as of May 14, 1979, Roark had done everything he was to do to motivate the 5% interest gift. If you look at the language of the letter itself, Stallworth recognized, in consideration of your originating my interest in the Bird Baker prospect, which had happened in the past, and your subsequent activity in acquiring other leases, which had happened in the past, therefore, I will give to you prospectively a 5% interest in everything I acquire. Now, request for admissions 1, 3, and 4 establish that it was merely Roark's past work which motivated the gift. Specifically, we know that before May 14, 1979, Roark originated the interest and engaged in the subsequent activity for an agreement of $150 per day plus expenses. We know from the letter agreement, the second paragraph, that he continued with his leasing efforts for the same $150 per day plus expenses. And from request for admissions 3 and 4, we know that he did nothing different or additional after May 14, 1979 than he had done before. The whole premise of an enforceable contract is that of mutuality. Roark operated at the same plane of work before and after May 14, 1979. He was motivated to do this work for the $150 a day plus expenses. Then the gift came in, per the letter agreement, of the 5% interest, and Roark did nothing to enlarge his efforts to create any additional consideration to support that additional compensation which Stallworth, in the letter, donated. So, the case law establishes that when the so-called consideration is merely that of past performance, that does not constitute legally sufficient consideration. Now, Mr. Ritchie earlier said that in our motion, we said that Stallworth gave no consideration to Stallworth. Well, that is what we're saying, that past performance, because it is legally insufficient, is no consideration. That's what the court held in Shear versus Harrington, which is found in the Court of Appeals brief, found at 226 Southwest 1st 554. It's an old case, but the facts are remarkably similar. In that case, an employee had done a great deal of work for 20 years. Then the employer decided to terminate him, but as a gratuity, he said, we will pay you a post-retirement salary of less than $100 a month. And that was in writing. Well, a couple years down the road, the company ran into trouble and could no longer afford to pay the man a post-retirement salary. And the court held that because that consideration provided by the former employee was merely in the past and was not supported by anything after the gift, that was legally insufficient consideration and therefore no consideration, and the contract was not enforceable. So that's the first point that the deemed admissions and the letter demonstrated to the trial court and the court of appeal. That was all Roark put up was past performance. That was legally insufficient consideration.
Counsel, do you agree that the deemed admission does not prove as a matter of law that no consideration flowed from Roark to Stallworth? And are you just relying upon your past consideration argument to support your summary judgment?
The deemed admissions show that no consideration passed from Roark to Stallworth because it says any no consideration which Roark got from Stallworth wasn't as gratuitous, wasn't as a gift. If it's a gift to Roark, and Roark did nothing to support that gift, if he gave no consideration to Stallworth to support that gift, to bring consideration into this deal, and to create an enforceable contract.
What do you rely upon to support your contention that Roark did nothing to Stallworth?
Numbers 3 and 4 and 1. The deemed admission show that Roark did nothing
During the time that he worked for Stallworth, the type of work which he performed and the hours he worked were substantially the same before and after. Number four, he did nothing different from or in addition to his responsibilities before and after May 14, 1979.
Does that contradict the express terms of the letter agreement?
No, Your Honor.
Born in consideration of your originating my interest in a subsequent activity?
That's right.
That expresses consideration in the contract, does not.
But the issue for this court is, just as in the Scheer case, the mere fact that the contract has language, it is the court's job to look to that language to determine whether or not, under the law, that constitutes legally sufficient consideration. This language shows that what Roark had done, originating my interest, that had been done in the past. That's not disputed. The subsequent leasing activity, that had been done in the past. That's not disputed. So that's the court's job, the trial court, the court of appeals, and this court. Sure, there's language in there, but does that language constitute legally sufficient consideration? If all the language shows, along with the deemed admissions, is that he did the same before and after, then it was past performance. And if the deemed admissions further show that it was a mere gratuity, then that shows no consideration. And therefore, once we look at the law as applied to the fact, as applied to the contract, there was no consideration. Now, the second point is this of the gratuity, as I was mentioning to Justice Corn, that it was and is a gift, and a gratuity resting on past services cannot furnish the basis of an enforceable right. A further case that holds this, cited in the Court of Appeals brief, is Underwood versus Hogg, 261 Southwest 1st, 556. In that case, again, there was a letter with a statement of consideration wherein the defendant said, I will give you a $250 credit on the debt that you owe me in consideration for looking after my interest down there and for favors shown me. In other words, for all these good things you've done in the past, I'll give you a $250 credit. Okay? The plaintiff sued on it. The court looked, saw that it was merely for past performance, and then held that that was not legally sufficient consideration and could not, therefore, enforce the contract. Furthermore, as Justice Corwin points out, the definition of gratuity means no consideration. Now, Mr. Ritchie said the only important request for admission is number two, and nowhere in it does it say no consideration. Well, it does say gratuitous, and under the cases I've cited in my brief, those are synonyms. The Ellibrock case cited in my brief says, a gift has been defined as a transfer of property made voluntarily and gratuitously without consideration. They are synonyms. They mean one and the same thing. Furthermore, Texas courts have repeatedly held that a court will not complete a gift or a promise to give absent detrimental reliance. In other words, Stallworth no doubt started out with the donative intent. They then got into a dispute about what the 5% interest meant, which led to the filing of the litigation. But no Texas court can complete a gift unless there is detrimental reliance. The cases that stand for that proposition, and I will state now that I will be filing a post-submission brief to give you these sites in full, but Fleck versus Baldwin, they were in the Court of Appeals brief, Fleck versus Baldwin, 172 Southwest 2nd 975, Texas Supreme Court, 1943, Woodworth versus Cortez, 660 Southwest 2nd, 561, and Cooper versus Durham, 565 Southwest 2nd, 308. These cases tell us what we've known since our first year in law school, that is, that a court cannot complete a gift unless there's detrimental reliance. That is exactly what Roark seeks to do by suing on this letter agreement. Then the third and final point which these deemed admissions established is that there was no detrimental reliance. That's what request for admission number five is. Roark was not induced by Stallworth to perform any additional work after May 1479 for Stallworth in reliance on any consideration received from Stallworth or to be received from Stallworth because of the May 1479 agreement. No detrimental reliance, therefore, no cause of action for promissory estoppel. They don't even suggest that they still have a cause of action for promissory estoppel. That issue was out of the case entirely after that deemed admission came in. So those are the three points, uncontroverted, which can't be contradicted or varied by any deposition excerpts or affidavit, which established, one, that the only thing Roark gave was his past performance, which is legally insufficient consideration. Two, what Stallworth gave Roark was a gratuity, nothing more. And three, there was no detrimental reliance, and therefore no basis for even attempting to enforce the gift. Now, this is a suit for specific performance in foreign accounting. And an essential element of both of the causes of action pleaded by Roark is that there must be legally sufficient consideration in this May 14, 1979 letter, or else it all goes away. That's an essential element. And by the dean's admissions, by the terms of the letter itself, establishing no legally sufficient consideration, then that essential element goes away, thereby extinguishing the viability of both the cause of action pleaded. That's Gray versus Bertrand from this court, 1987, and Sakowitz versus Steck from this court, 1984.
Now, consideration is a defense, an affirmative defense. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Was it pleaded?
No, Your Honor, that issue is not before this court. That was point of error number one.
The entire case is before the court, even though we grant on certain points. Tell me why a party should be able to get a summary judgment on grounds not pleaded.
This was the basis of the Court of Appeals' opinion. Nowhere was the pleading defect raised prior to the court's granting summary judgment or afterward. That is the holding in the City of Houston versus Clear Creek, that no party can lay behind the log and think of things after. They have to bring these issues forward in their response. And nowhere in the response did they point out that pleading defect. That's the whole purpose for the rule. This case is so old, I forgot what was in my pleading. If they'd raised it, it would have been a simple formality, pleading amendment, set a new hearing 21 days later, and we would have had the result. But it wasn't pointed out until long after the summary judgment had been entered, and that's the reason why the case appears as it does before Your Honor.
Clear Creek doesn't go quite so far as to address this point, except perhaps in spirit, but do you know of any cases which directly hold that summary judgment may be granted on a claim or defense not expressly raised in the case?
Yes, Your Honor, the case of Jones versus McSpedden, which was cited in the Court of Appeals brief. Dallas, 1977 holds exactly that. Now, in responding to Mr. Ritchie's point in his oral argument, he wants to bring out this idea that the deemed admissions are mere conclusions. That's an argument that he thought of for the first time after the Court of Appeals had ruled, and so it was not properly preserved. I think I've addressed the other points that Mr. Ritchie brought forward about why we think the request for admission establishes that this was a gift, and because of the other request for admission, Roark delivered nothing new, nothing to support this new gift. The whole basis of an enforceable contract is that idea of mutuality, and there simply was no mutuality here. That concludes my presentation. If Your Honors have any additional questions, I'll be happy to answer.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel.
If it pleases the court, Bowles versus Texas National Bank is precisely in point, and the case is cited there under. There was absolutely no pleading of the affirmative defense of want of consideration. making a difference whether there is a response filed at all. The only issues, he says, counsel says that Mr. Ritchie didn't raise it in his plea, in his response. But summary judgment, the only issues before the court upon which a summary judgment can be granted, is that raised by the pleading. There's absolutely no pleading of any want of consideration or failure of consideration.
That's your, you continue your Bowles case, of course, that.
Absolutely.
If a party asserts at trial a claim or defense which has not been pleaded, it may be held to have been tried by consent if there's no objection. Why shouldn't that same rule apply in summary judgment practice?
Because summary judgments are judiciary article of the Texas Constitution, place on a high esteem the right to decide your case by a jury. Summary judgments are not favored in law. The issues made by the pleadings are all that the opposing party should anticipate. And if there's no allegation of any failure of consideration, it's not before the court. It's upon which the summary judgment can be granted. Now, it doesn't work the reverse way. If there are no pleadings and a defense to a summary judgment is shown by the evidence that could amend and bring in that issue, well, then it doesn't work that way.
Why not?
In reverse. Because summary judgments are not favored.
So any way you keep from getting a summary judgment, is that's the rule. Whichever rule.
When the rule says an issue is not before the court unless affirmatively pleaded, it means just that. And there is no pleading bringing this before the trial court. And
why should
allegations in a summary judgment.
Why should a defense to summary judgment be before the court? Because it's not pleaded any more than a claim.
For the simple reason that it is error, for instance, if it shows an issue, a fact did exist and could be pleaded, since summary judgments are not favored, the man is entitled to have an opportunity to plead it after that's pointed out. Now, here's the big distinction apart from that, the big distinction on the merits. He keeps talking about no showing of any harmful reliance, which is in the form of estoppel. That's when you're dealing with an executory contract or an executory gift. This is not an executory contract or an executory gift. This is an executed written instrument. And for instance, a man tells me, if you will do certain things for me, I shall deed you Blackacre, convey you Blackacre. I do it. He conveys me Blackacre, doesn't even recite any consideration. There's consideration for that contract. He's carrying out an oral agreement for what he led to me to believe. So the burden is on he who asserts failure a want of consideration to plead it and prove it. It's a high burden, and this is an actual conveyance in presenti. This fellow says, in consideration of what so-and-so, I will in the future grant to you these interests. I grant in presenti right now. He can grant it and convey it at that moment, that interest. It doesn't make any difference whether there's any consideration or not. That was a valid in presenti transfer of title to that expectancy that this man had. Now, if the court please, this is simply a matter of enforcing the good faith actions of this man. He recites consideration, all written estimates import a valid consideration. Standing to start with, that's the first principle involved. This man recites there was consideration for his action, and then he thereafter makes a transfer in presentile. Doesn't make any difference whether you've got the element of an estoppel, like an executor contract. I agreed to give you Black Acre in the future on account of you've been good to me in the past. Then that's where your detrimental reliance might come in. That in actuality it's a form of estoppel, which is a matter that also is needs to be pleaded.
You're saying that it was, for instance, in the form of a bonus paid immediately?
We don't know. We don't know just what it is. The written instrument says, in consideration of so and so and so and so, I convey to you or grant to you. It doesn't make a difference which word he used.
Because of your goodwill and loyalty through the last 20 years, I'm going to give you this. I mean, if it's an immediate gift, it's a gift.
In
if it was a stock certificate, it would have been his stock certificate, right?
That's right. Now, somewhere later, he and heir is wanting to renege on that absolute transfer in presentile. Now, this mere statement, a detrimental alliance, has nothing to do with a gift, where it's a gift in presentile. The law doesn't favor the Indian giver.
Are you arguing that this is a gift, a completed gift? Are you arguing that there was consideration and therefore your suit for specific performance must proceed to trial because this issue has been joined?
I say there is consideration. The instrument recites consideration. Therefore, the presumption is consideration. The written contract, even if it hadn't recited it, imports consideration. And a statement and an admission that what he got out of this contract or expects to get is gratuity. The word gratuity can mean many things. That he was not compelled to do it, it can mean. And detrimental reliance is not involved, as counsel thought. This is a transfer in presentile of an expectancy this man then had. Thank you, counsel.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes argument in the first clause. The court will take a brief recess.